This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We tape in the offices of Raider Solutions, located in the Light Center in Lafayette. Raider offers a complete fleet of IT solutions for businesses of all sizes. If you're wondering if Raider can help your business, please visit RaiderSolutions.com. I'd also like to thank Iberia Bank for its support. Founded in 1887, Iberia Bank is the largest bank based in Louisiana and is headquartered in Lafayette with 325 combined locations throughout the South. They offer the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit iberiabank.com for more information. And lastly, thank you for the support of Lafayette General Health. As Acadiana's largest nonprofit community-owned regional health system, Lafayette General Health is committed to restoring, maintaining, and improving health in the communities it serves. For more information, visit LafayetteGeneral.com. Yvette Landry is our guest today. Inducted into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame on October 12, 2019, Yvette's creative prowess and energy are inspirational. Playing a variety of instruments in several Cajun bands, Yvette also fronts the Yvette Landry Band. Her debut award-winning album, Should Have Known, was released in 2010 and named Offbeat Magazine's Best Country Folk Album, and Yvette was named Best Country Folk Artist. She has since released four more CDs. In 2014, Yvette received a Grammy nomination for Best Regional Roots Music Album, Light the Stars. She was named Louisiana's Music Ambassador in 2013 and 2019. You might think that Yvette defines her profession as musician, but she is also a private homeschool educator and teaches American Sign Language and songwriting at UL Lafayette. She is an author. And her first children's book, The Ghost Tree, was nominated for Louisiana Young Reader's Choice Award. This book, along with her second, Madame Grand Dois, were both formally accepted into the Library of Congress collection for children's literature. And her latest project is a book-album combo that focuses on swamp pop legend Warren Storm, which I'm going to let Yvette tell you about. I've been talking long enough. Yvette Landry, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure and honor to be sitting here.
I'm honored. You know, we were kidding before. We're friends on Facebook, but didn't know each other.
No.
And your story is beyond inspirational. And it seems like you say yes to life.
Yeah, you know, I didn't even realize that until an interview several months ago when the headline came out, and it was just Say Yes was what he titled the story, and I didn't realize it, but really and truly, that's kind of how it went. I've had a very interesting life, and this second part of my life, I guess, basically started when I turned 40 and bought a bass guitar, and you know, at that point in my life, I was just thinking, I'm just going to say yes to whatever whatever comes, and we'll see what happens. And
you were at a crossroads.
I really was. Yeah. I really was. And
let's back up.
Yeah.
And let's talk about your first half so that we can get the full import of what happened. So you're a Brobridge native?
I am, yes. I was born and raised in Brobridge, Louisiana, and I moved away one time. I came all the way to Lafayette.
Oh, gosh.
Past Acadiana Mall.
Big city girl? Yeah.
Yes, and when I moved back to Brobridge, it's probably 20 years later, I remember a friend from New York came, and they were visiting at the house, and they said, well, have you always lived here? And I said, no, this is my grandparents' home. I moved back about 2 years ago. And they said, oh, really? Where'd you move from? I said, Lafayette. And this look of confusion was on their face, and they said, but isn't that right down the road? And I said, you know, it takes 30 minutes to get to my mom's house on Sundays. So
that's funny.
That was my big move. But no, I was born and raised in Brobridge, and that's where my heart is, and that's where I love to be.
Well, we're talking about your music career pretty much today. Yet you were in the band in high school. What did you play?
Well, I started playing piano at 3 years old. My aunt was a music teacher. She had a piano at her house, and my grandparents had a piano there. And I'd tinker around on it. And I did piano all through high school. And then in the fourth grade, probably, I started on clarinet. And as I went through high school, I ended up playing all the woodwinds. I did flute and saxophone and oboe and all that stuff. And I really didn't enjoy playing music. I enjoyed
those instruments.
The competition.
Right.
of playing music when you were in high school. That's kind of what you did. You know, you'd play in the band, but then you'd also go to these competitions. And I enjoyed the competitive part of it. And I was also a volleyball player and an athlete. And I loved that.
Right.
So I did the music basically because my parents made me, and I enjoyed the competitiveness of it. But my heart and soul was into sports and athletics.
You come from a musical family.
I do. I do come from a musical family. My aunt was a music teacher and piano. She played piano and organ for 30 plus years. My dad, when he was in college over here at, I think it was SLU at the time, was in a barbershop quartet. And my grandparents on my father's side were both musicians, and they had a family of 13 and 14 brothers and sisters,
oh,
and they were all musicians. And on my dad's mother's side of the family, I've traced it back all the way through probably six or seven generations of musicians. That the first Hebert that came through down from Nova Scotia was a fiddle player.
Okay.
He played sort of Celtic Irish music.
Right, right. Yeah. Did you sing as a young girl?
I was in the chorus, but I just, I really didn't think I could sing. And I think if you fast forward to when I decided to start singing, when I started playing in a Cajun band, I went to a workshop one weekend and I told the lady that she made me sing a song for her. And she said, "Why do you think you can't sing?" And I said, because when I sing on the radio, it's too high or it's too low, and I just don't like my voice. And you know, I started playing Cajun music, and the way that works is you play with an accordion is like a harmonica. It's one key. So I was playing with a C or a D accordion. I don't remember what it was, but my voice wouldn't, it just wouldn't work. And she looked at me and she said, "Well, doggone it, girl, change the key." And I said, "Wait, what?" And she said, "Yeah." She said, "Let me show you this." And she gave me a capo. And because I only knew three chords on the acoustic guitar at the time. And she said, "Look, you put this right here and that changes the key." And eventually, what she told me was that, you know, it was okay to not sing the song in the original key that it was written in. You could match it to your voice.
Do
and she
works.
Said, "And I'll tell you something else." She said, "You surround yourself with musicians who can play in whatever key you sing in. And if they can't," she said, "you fire them."
It's your life journey.
So yeah. That's what, you know, that's what I did.
That's so cool.
But I was in the chorus for a couple of years in high school, but I really didn't think I could sing.
And then you went to college, you got a master's.
I graduated high school, closed the piano case, the lid, closed the instrument cases, and just put that away and said, "I never want to do that again." And I did. I went to college for two semesters and decided I'd rather have a new car than a college degree. So I quit and went to work for an oil company. And about halfway through the 10-year stint there, I decided that I wanted to be an educator. So I went to night school, and they allowed me to go to school and work. And I ended up getting a degree in education, and then continued on to my master's and continued on to almost getting my plus 30. And I was an educator, and I coached volleyball, and I was an athlete. I played. I was, I guess you could say, semi-professional in volleyball, and traveled all around doing that.
So you taught at ASA, I read.
I did, yeah.
When did you teach there?
Well, I did 10 years in Lafayette Parish, and then in the year 2000, I went over to ESA. And I taught from 2000 to 2013.
Okay. I have a graduate from there, Kelly Swift. She graduated in 2017, but she was there. You know, would have been younger, but so you were an educator.
Yes, and still
and that
am.
Was but I mean that was really your
but
main
that was my
profession.
Yeah, that's what I was. If you and it's even it's really difficult even today when somebody asks what I am.
Do you do? Yeah.
You know, that's not as easy as it seems. But my first inkling is to always say I'm an educator because I think that's what I was really born to be. But I don't think you have to be born just to do one thing. And so I really think I was also born to play music and to write as well.
So you just picked up the bass guitar?
Yeah. So if you fast forward, you know, I had a teaching career and, like I said, a coaching career. We had several state championships coaching volleyball, and that was going well. And then in 2009... the bottom kind of fell out. You know, my dad was diagnosed with brain cancer, and my marriage was kind of falling apart, and we were doing a lot of trips back and forth to MD Anderson, so I couldn't really do the things that I like to do that was stress relief, which was, you know, play tennis or play softball or play volleyball or do, you know, these things. And so, you know, one day I just said, I've got to do something or I'm going to just, you know, crash and burn. So I was driving on Johnson Street and I saw a CNM music store. Yeah. And I just pulled into the parking lot and I got down.
Like, you don't know why?
I don't know why. I have no idea why. And the guy goes, can I help you? And I said, yep, I want to buy a bass guitar. And he said, well, what kind would you like, you know? And I said, I have no idea. And he said, so you don't know the brand that you want? And I said, no. And he said, well, do you want a 4-string or a 5-string or a 6-string? I said, I don't know. And he said, well, do active pickup, passive pickup? I said, dude, where are they? And he pointed to a rack on the wall, and I'm looking at him, and, you know, one was red, one was blue.
Yeah, they all look the same otherwise.
You know, so I said, well, give that one, and that one. And it was almost like Goldilocks. You know, he gave me the first one, and I'm like, ooh, this one feels really heavy. And then he gave me the second one, and I said, well, wow, this one's really wide. And then he gave me the third one, and I held it, and then I remember thinking, well, it's not too heavy, and it's not too wide. I'll take it.
This feels just right.
And so, you know, I bring the guitar up to check out, and he goes, ma'am, he said, do you realize that's an electric bass guitar? And I looked at him and I said, and? He said, you need an amp with that if it's going to work. And I said, okay, well, then get me an amp. And he goes, well, do you want? And I just kind of threw him that teacher look, you know,
yeah,
and
like,
he goes,
just get it.
I'll go get you one. So he came back with this little amp the size of a purse, you know. I mean, it was really kind of tiny, which was perfect because my only desire was to mess around with it when I was at home, or I figured I could even bring it with me when we traveled to MD Anderson, and it was just something that I could mess around with to kind of get my mind off of what was going on. And
but you'd never picked a guitar.
I had never picked any kind of stringed instrument.
Okay.
No, nothing like that. And you know, when I was in school, and I think the reason why I enjoyed music so much the second time around was because I did everything by ear. I didn't have to read music, and I didn't have a teacher telling me, you got to play this part loud, and look, it says, you know, pianissimo right here, you got to be really soft here, or, you know, and I had nobody over my shoulder telling me what to do. Whatever I was listening to in my head, I could figure it out on the strings, and I could make it work.
So you were just listening to music you liked, and then trying to play along with
it. And then I had a friend who I was teaching with at the time, her husband and his entire family were all musicians in Cajun music. And I saw one of them, Brazos Huval. As a matter of fact, he plays with Steve Riley and the Mamu Playboys. And Brazos saw me in town one day, and he said, I heard you bought a bass guitar. And I said, yeah, sure did. And he said, you know, they got this Cajun jam at this little place on Moss Street. You know, you ought to go check it out. And I did not grow up listening to Cajun music. I mean, it was on the radio on Saturday mornings because my family listened to it, but that was the only radio show. You know, we didn't actively go out seeking that. I grew up listening to swamp pop and rhythm and blues. You know, I love the old Motown stuff and classic. It was, you know, country of the day, which is classic country now, basically. So when he told me that, I was like, okay, whatever, and just kind of blew it off. And a couple of weeks later, I just happened to be on Moss Street, and I happened to see the store that he was talking about. So I pulled in, and you know, the guy, I asked where the jam was, and he said, look, oh, it's in the back over there, go. And when I opened the door, there was this back room, and they probably had 50 to 60 people in there, from 6 years old to 86 years old, you know, and they were all playing music just acoustically in this Cajun jam, all in a circle, and everybody was laughing and telling stories in between each song and having a great time. And I was so intrigued, and it was something internally clicked for me, like, this is where I'm supposed to be.
That's why you stopped at the music store. Like, it was...
Yeah, I didn't know why I was stopping other than, oh, that's the place that he was telling me about.
But it made sense.
Not because I wanted to go hear or find what they were doing. I just, it's like, oh, let me pull in and see. And when I opened that door, it definitely connected with me. And so I asked the guy, I said, hey, look, I've got this electric guitar, bass guitar, and it's a really small amp because everybody was acoustic. I said, could I come maybe just sit in the back and just see if I can pick something out? And he's like, absolutely, you know, come on. And so I went, and it was the most amazing thing. And it was just a learning experience, you know, not only learning how to play the bass guitar, but learning about my culture and learning about the music and meeting new people in this world that my ancestors were in, but I just had never really delved into that yet. And so, you know, a couple of months later, I got offered to go play a gig at Randall's Restaurant.
You must have been pretty good. I was early on.
I don't know. They, you know, and that was one of the things. And I remember, and that's probably where the guy who was doing the interview got this, because I remember thinking, you know, this guy who I didn't know asked me to play a gig, and I told him, I've only had this thing for a couple of months, and I don't know the music. And he said his name was Randy Vedrine, and he's with the Lafayette Rhythm Devils, and I still play with them to this day. And I remember thinking, well, you know what, dude? I just got finished telling you that I don't know how to play bass guitar. I only got it a couple months ago, and I don't know Cajun music. And you're still asking me to play this gig. So if you're crazy enough to ask, I'm crazy enough to say yes. Because what's the worst that can happen? I'll play the gig, and if I really suck, then you're not going to call me back. But, you know, oh, what fun it would have been.
Yeah. And you hate regrets. So, you know, you don't want to regret
something. So at that point, you know, like I said, my dad had just been diagnosed, and I was just thinking about a bunch of things that he said he was going to do and never did. So I was like, I'm going to do it. And I walked up that Wednesday night. I walked up to Randall's Restaurant, and I was carrying my little amp, like I said, about the size of a purse. And this is a guy who had been in the music business all his life. So when a bass player would show up, they would have a stack, you know, to play. And I walked in the back, and he looked at me, and he goes, "What's that?" And I said, "That's my amp." And he almost fell on the floor laughing, because, I mean, it's all I had. But I played the gig, and he hired me the next day.
Did you enjoy it?
I had so much fun.
Did it just come like you were able to naturally kind of feel your way through the music?
I think it was the most stressful time, 3 hours, that I've ever spent, because Randy had turned around and was talking to me the whole time. He was asking me, "So do you like LSU? So do you like the Saints?" So, you know, so here I am, not knowing what I'm doing, not knowing the music, trying to concentrate on all that, and he's trying to have conversation with me, you know, so if he wasn't singing, he was talking to me. So I guess it was stressful, but at the same time, I did well enough to where they hired me. So something must have come naturally. I must have been able to do something right.
Gosh.
But that's how I got hired.
So how did it unfold? I know you've played with several bands. Were you with his band?
Well, yes. Yeah, so he hired me. Well, like
still
I said,
I'm still with
that band. Yeah, and we had a regular gig at Randall's Restaurant every Wednesday, and I did that for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then we'd play festivals and we'd travel. And we recorded. I recorded 3 albums with that band, and we did tours in Germany, and we went to France, and we did festivals all around the United States. And then a year after that, I was given a scholarship to Louisiana Folk Roots to go do a week-long intensive in Cajun music on the bass guitar. And during that time, I got interested in learning how to play accordion and guitar and fiddle. And I met a girl, Christy Guillory, who was a great Cajun musician for a long time, and we decided to start a band together, and we came up with a band called Bonsoir Catin, which is Good Night Doll in Cajun music. But if you're not a Cajun French speaker and just a regular French speaker, Catin in France has a very different connotation, which is I guess I'll say it.
I think I know.
A lady of the night, shall we say? And it was quite interesting when Bonsoir Catin toured in France, you know, because
lady
they're looking
the
at, you know, basically you whore. You know, but I did that for 10 years, and it was with that band that we got the Grammy nomination for Like the Stars.
And you had a third member, was it...
It was myself and Christy and Anya Burgess, who has solo violins downtown, and Christine Balfa.
Christine Balfa. So four of you.
Yes, yeah,
so
it was the four of us.
What a great group.
Yeah.
So you were doing, you were still teaching, or were
you? Oh, I was still teaching, yes. And I tell you what, that was a clash of the titans right there,
because,
you know, I had my teaching and coaching. Yeah. And so during cross country and volleyball, we would usually practice in the mornings before school. Mm. So my wake-up time was 4 a.m., and playing music, my going-to-bed time was 2 a.m.
Gosh.
So there was a period of a good 5 or 6 years where
No sleep. Very little sleep. Huh?
Right.
But
and
going
then,
on energy.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely.
Yeah.
You know.
So that band, is that still in existence?
It is. I am no longer with them, but they are still performing, and most of them have young kids now. Mm-hmm. So I think they don't play as often as they used to.
But that's nice.
But they're growing families right now.
So I know I've read you've traveled the world. I mean, this opened up a vista for you that probably never could have foreseen.
Never. Or been able to do on a teacher's salary, you know?
Right.
So it has been wonderful. And my son, who is a drummer in my Yvette Landry band, you know, I kind of told him that you just say yes to these gigs. And, mm-hmm. and you know, if they offer to tour in Germany for 3 weeks and the pay is not great, you still say yes because...
Yeah, you get to go to Germany.
You get to go to Germany for 3 weeks and you still come home with money in your pocket. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not... I didn't do this to get rich, and you certainly don't make a whole lot of money doing it. But you get there's so much more.
What a rich life!
And so much more important than just monetary.
So you've played at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. You've played at the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville.
Yeah.
You've been a cultural ambassador, which I love this on behalf of the Library of Congress.
Yeah.
And
went out
what
to
was
Russia.
That like?
Oh my
I mean,
God, that
goodness.
Was a. I mean, can you imagine going to Russia for 2 weeks and bringing your Cajun music and your Louisiana culture?
How did they receive it?
It was very interesting. At first, I'm gonna make a blanket statement and say the majority of Russians do not smile.
Oh,
they just don't. You know,
so
it's
you don't
not
really
part
know what
of
they're
their
thinking.
Culture. And
yeah.
and it's. It was the United States sent us over there to be cultural ambassadors to kind of change the view of what they had been told for so many years, mm-hmm. you know, because their view of what America and Americans are was very different because they were told differently. So initially when we'd go play, and our music is all about fun and good time and dancing and community and, you know, so we'd start, and this stoic audience who didn't understand English, much less French, or the music, you know, would just sit there with nothing. But it was a very beautiful thing to see because it was almost like a butterfly coming out of a cocoon. You know, by the end of the experience, they couldn't help themselves. The music literally changed and move them.
That's beautiful.
To such an experience where they were standing and clapping. And I remember this one night in particular. We were at a factory where they made tanks. And they were told after their 12-hour day of working that they were going to a concert and tickets would be provided and everybody was expected to show up. So, you know, their days were very long. But at the end, like I said, at the end, they were up and smiling and dancing in their seats. And they lined up after the performance to walk up on stage to get us to sign their programs. And they would just say, spasiba, spasiba, which was thank you. And then they would speak in Russian and then say, spasiba, spasiba again. So it was just a wow moment.
And they probably don't look at the U.S. by region like we do.
No.
You know, they just think
one,
U.S.
Right,
yeah.
Just kind of like
America,
I said, no Russian smiles.
yeah,
exactly.
So they wouldn't know if you were from New York or
right, and
South
it was
Louisiana.
An eye-opener for me as well, you know, because I had a certain kind of view of what Russia was. Mm-hmm. So it was a learning experience on both parts.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you've also served twice as Louisiana's music ambassador.
Right.
How did that come about? How do you get selected to represent
you know,
our
my
state?
Mom asked me that question all the time about everything that happens to me.
Like, how
does
that
happen? And my answer is, they just call. I don't know. I don't know. I really don't know. I got a call from them.
Is that the, like, Lieutenant Governor's
the Lieutenant,
office?
Lieutenant Governor's office. Both times, I guess because of the festivals that I was going around and playing, and I was awarded, you know, went to Lieutenant Governor's office, and they gave me a little trophy and a certificate signed. And then the next time they called and they said, we want to do a promotion, and we want you to be an ambassador, and Oxford American Magazine's going to come, and they're going to shoot a video, and, wow. and we're going to do all this stuff. And it was just, and I'd say, okay, mm-hmm. come on.
So what a year for you, 2019. Oh,
it's been well, you know, it's been since 2010, even since 2004 when I picked up the guitar. Every year, at the end of the year, I go, oh my God, you know, mm-hmm. this is, okay, so this is it. It can't possibly
get
any better. Mm-hmm. So brace yourself, because next year you're going to come down from this high that you've been on this year. And every year it just, more and more stuff happens. Gosh. It's just unbelievable. And I'm so grateful and so thankful.
So this year at the Festival of Acadien, mm-hmm. I know it was a big, I know you're saying every year has been great, but this really was a wonderful year.
It's just crazy.
Yeah, to be inducted into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame. And this year was more of a focus on women also, right?
Right. So, and that was just serendipity.
I know there aren't many. There aren't many like you that are
Yeah. It wasn't,
your level.
Again, that wasn't planned mm-hmm. either. You know, it just happened when Mike Shepherd from the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame called me. I didn't know who he was other than I had heard his name mentioned when I was interviewing Warren Storm mm-hmm. for my latest project that I've been working on. And so when I got the call from Mike Shepherd, I just assumed that he was calling because he heard about the project. He had inducted Warren into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame, and he was calling for a book or an album or whatever. And I was on my way to work. And so he starts talking, and he's introducing himself, and then he's telling me about the Hall of Fame and who's been inducted and da-da-da-da. And 30 minutes later, I'm still on the phone with him, and I'm getting ready to get out, you know, and I didn't want to be rude. So I said, I'm really sorry, but I got to step into this meeting over here. Mm-hmm. Is there something that I can help you with? And I totally had a pencil and paper to write down his address mm-hmm. so that I could mail the book that he was going to ask me for. And he said, Oh, yeah. The reason why I'm calling. Hey, do you think you could send me a high-res photo of yourself? Because we're going to be inducting you into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame. And I almost dropped the phone. I said, wait, what? Could you say that again, please? I don't think I heard you correctly. And he said it again. And I said, oh, wow, you know, wow. And then I hung up the phone with him. And then he called me back a couple of days later. And he said, look, do you have any gigs coming up? Because we can do it in Baton Rouge, but sometimes I like to do it at a person's gig mm-hmm. so their family and everything can be around. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, I'm playing with Yvette Landry and the Jukes, and we don't have that many gigs, but we are playing at Festivals Acadien. My family's all coming. I wonder if we could do it there.
That's nice.
And he said, oh, yeah, you know, I did Wayne Toops there, and I did somebody else mm-hmm. there. That would be fun. I can call and ask them. And neither one of us had even made the connection that they were dedicating the festival to women in Cajun music and, mm-hmm. and women in Louisiana music. So again,
another one of those things, serendipity.
It was serendipity, yeah. Uh-huh. It was just another one of those moments.
How did it feel while it was happening?
Well, you know, it's hard to really process in the moment. It's after the fact mm-hmm. when you go home and you sit down and you think about, you just kind of rewind to the day. But it was really special because my son was there. He works offshore, and he had been offshore for 27 days with no plan on coming back. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened the day before, they had a guy who had to go home, and they went up to Trevor, and they said, hey, you've been here for a little while, right? And he said, yeah, 27 days. And they said, well, so-and-so's going home. How'd you like to go home for the weekend? And so he said, yeah. And so he got there that Friday night, and I was being inducted on Saturday, and they called him to go back the Sunday morning. So again, the universe put my son with me for that day, and my mom was there. And so, you know, like I said, in the moment, it's hard to really process that. But mm-hmm. when you go and you sit back and you think about it, I pretty much live in disbelief because I can't believe that it's all happening. But it does. I mean, I go back and I see pictures and I'm like, yep, it happened.
That was me.
It happened. Yep.
You live open to, may I say God? I mean, you live open to direction.
All of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of that.
Any way that it wants to
show itself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you've played with some big names, national, international, big names. I mean, you want to name drop a few?
Well, I'll be going back to Nashville in December to sing with Vince Gill and the Time Jumpers.
I love that. What a talent, huh?
There. And
what is he like?
He's, you know, just like you and I. And I know there's people in this room that can attest to that, too. When you're just around them, they're just they're just regular people, you know. But it's when you take a step back.
Yeah.
I got to hang out with Bono and Edge of the U2 guys. And most recently, John Fogerty just recorded on this latest album that I produced for Warren Storm and was a part of. And when you see them in their element, they're larger than life. But when you're one-on-one with them, they're just, you know, regular guys.
Okay, guys.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Let's see, who else? I was driving down, and Hank Williams, Bo Cephas, called me on the phone one day. I almost went in the ditch. Robert Plant, I got to.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Daryl Scott, who's a great songwriter in Nashville. I mean, he's one of my go-to guys. And then again, you go home and you sit back and you go, holy crap, John Fogerty just called me and recorded on my album. How does that happen? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, holy crap, you know, Bo Cephas just called me and wants me to one day air him my latest CD. And you go, wait, what?
But I have a feeling, Yvette, that a lot of these talents were called like you. And they answered their call.
I think so.
They followed their heart. I mean, you know, similar to what you did.
Yeah.
Maybe a different timeline.
Right.
But same impulse to do what felt right.
Yeah, you know, that makes me think about when my son was probably in the sixth or seventh grade, probably the sixth grade, you know, I was holding down 3 and 4 jobs. And, you know, it was just a really dark time. And he said, you know, when I grow up, I want to be just like you. And I thought, oh, that's such a sweet thing to say. And I said, oh, really? How so? He said, you don't work. And I wanted to strangle him. Because in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, my God, I get up every morning at 4. Da, 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 da. And I said, oh, my God, Trevor, you know, I'm working 5 jobs right now. I'm not getting any sleep, and I'm about to tear up. And he goes, yeah, but you love everything you do. It's not really work if you love it. And I just thought, that is probably the most amazing thing anyone has ever said to me. Mm-hmm. And when you take a step back, it is not work, you know? And it's kind of like you're called to do it. And it's you just do it because you love it. And I love everything that I do, from the teaching to the music to the writing.
And recording another album and writing another book. You want to talk about your current project with Warren Storm?
Yes, I will. You know, and again,
explain who he is for people that may not know his background.
I sure will. Again, it's one of those things where this was bigger than me. I didn't know I was supposed to be doing this, but the universe did. So Warren Storm is someone who I grew up listening to. He's known as the godfather of swamp pop, which is kind of Louisiana rock and roll blues. I don't even know how to describe it. It's kind of Elvis-y, kind of Fats Domino. It's got a little bit of Louisiana, New Orleans rhythm to it. It's got a little bit of rock and roll rhythm to it, bunch of blues to it, and it's dance music. And it's what Southwest Louisiana, you know, you've got Cajun music and you've got swamp pop music, and it's just dance music. But anyway, I grew up listening and dancing to Warren Storm, and he was larger than life in my eyes. And if you've never seen him, he's 82 right now. And ever since he was young, I mean, he just, this jet black hair jet black mustache. And to this day, he still has the jet black hair and jet black mustache. And as much as I admired the man, and he lived 14 miles down the road, I had never met him. And so I was playing a gig, my regular Thursday night gig at Buck and Johnny's with my steel guitar player, and I'm setting up, and I look out the window, and I see this jet black hair and this jet black mustache about ready to walk in the door. And I grabbed over to Richard's, you know, my steel guitar, and I said, oh my God, oh my God, Warren Storm's about to walk in the building. And this was huge to me because my latest album, Louisiana Lovin', we recorded one of his signature songs, which was I Need Somebody Bad. And so I'm freaking out, and Rich goes, well, yeah, I invited him. And I totally forgetting that Richard had played music with him for 14 years in Little Band of Gold. Mm-hmm. So Warren comes in with a couple of, you know, musicians his age, and they sit down right in front of us. And, you know, immediately your stomach just drops because here's your icon, and here are these fabulous musicians that made their career playing music sitting right in front of you. And Richard goes, oh, you know what? We need to play his song. And I looked at him and I said, absolutely not. There is no way that I am singing Warren Storm's song with Warren Storm singing right there. No, it's not happening. And before I could finish the sentence, Richard started playing the song. And I'm like, oh, crap. Now, you know, so I just closed my eyes and voice shaking and sang the song in front of Warren. And at the end of the night, he came up to me and he shook my hand. And he said, you know, I've never heard a woman sing that song before. And he kind of winked and he said, you did a good job, little girl. You did a good job. And so I ended up talking to Richard about Warren, and I said, tell me about him. So he was telling me his story a little bit, and he said, you know, his wife passed away 7 years ago, and he, you know, kind of been depressed since then, and he doesn't really get out that much. And so I said, well, you know what? I'm going to take him to lunch tomorrow, and I'm going to bring him a copy of my CD so he'll have that song. And that's all I wanted to do. So I did. I picked him up and went to lunch with him and visited him with him. And when I went to drop him off, he said, hey, do you think you could come in for a little while? I want to show you a picture. So I said, oh, absolutely. So I went down into his apartment, and he pulls out this big bin of pictures, and he's looking for one in particular. And so as he's taking out the pictures, he's putting it down on the table, and there's like Warren and Willie Nelson and Warren and Ray Price. And then he pulls out a picture of Elvis that says, to Warren, you know, thanks for whatever. And it's all, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, looking at this man going, who are you? You know, you played at the Pat Showboat, you know, you play Swamp Pop. Who is this guy? Mm-hmm. And so I went home, and I get home, and I'm talking to my husband. We're sitting on the back porch, and I'm talking 1,000 miles an hour. And then he's telling me so about da-da-da-da-da. You know, I'm just going back and forth. And my husband is very patiently listening to me, you know, rant and rave. And
knowing
and,
what's going to happen. Huh?
And then he says, you know, he said, I think I have your next project. And I immediately, I said, what, are you out of your mind? I said, my record hasn't even been formally released yet. I just spent every last penny I have on this record. I can't do another record. You know, and that's what I'm thinking. He said, no. He said, hear me out. He said, obviously you love hearing Warren Storm stories. Obviously Warren would love for you to visit with him once a week to be able to tell his stories. So this is what you're going to do, he said. You're going to go visit, and you're going to listen to his stories, and you're going to record them, and you're going to take his pictures, and you're going to write his story, and we're going to put it in a book, and we're going to call it Taking the World by Storm.
Oh, gosh.
And I looked at him, and I said, no. I can't do it. I cannot be responsible for writing somebody's life. No, I'm not an author. No. You know, and he said, don't answer now. Sleep on it, and then just think about it. So I did. I slept on it, and the next morning I woke up and I said, look, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to call UL Press, and I'm going to tell them what I'm thinking about doing. And if they say yes, and if Warren says yes, then I'll do it. And if they say no, I'm not doing it. That's it. And he goes, fair enough. So I called UL Press, totally thinking that they would either say no or maybe in 10 years or maybe in 5 years. And so I called and I told them about the project, and they said, can we have it printed by October?
That was last
June.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. So actually it might have been May, because June 1st is when I decided I would start interviewing Warren, and I did. And so from June 1st of last year to May 31st of this year is I recorded, went visited, and I'm happy to say he's my new best friend.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so in the process of writing the book, I didn't do it like a typical biography. It's the subtitle is A Conversation with Warren Storm. Mm-hmm. And I wanted everybody to feel what I was feeling sitting with him at his table, listening to his stories. Mm-hmm. So it's written in conversation form. It's kind of question and answer. It has about 300 photographs in it. He's got a wealth of just photos that he's taken all his life. that's in there. And so when you read it, and I think I pulled it off, when you read it, mm-hmm. you just sort of feel like you're in the conversation right. listening.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to spoil the book, but what did he say about Elvis? Did he have anything like a particular?
He did memory? Actually, because that was one of my first questions I mm-hmm. asked him. I pulled out that picture from Elvis and I said, I want to know.
Yeah.
I mean, what is this all about?
What's up with that?
And he said in 1957 or 58, I don't remember which year it was, he was 21 years old. He recorded his first song and it charted on nationally on Billboard chart. And he had gone up to Memphis to a Wink Martindale show. It was something like an American Bandstand uh-huh. show. And he was going to perform on it. And Wink Martindale and Elvis Presley were really good friends. And Wink said, hey, look, Elvis is in town. Do you want to go and meet him? He's listening to the show. Mm-hmm. And Warren said, absolutely. And it was him and his friend from Abbeville. I mean, imagine, you're 21 years old.
Right.
And so Wink Martindale wrote a note and gave it to Warren and said, look, take a cab, go to Graceland, and give this note to the guy at the gate. So he tells the story about how he went to the gate and they didn't think they were going to get in. And they called him in and he went into Graceland. He said Elvis was having a party. They were probably about 15, 16 people there. Elvis was at his piano uh-huh. playing and singing. And when Warren walked through the door, he's like, Warren, come on in. He sat down at the piano bench with Elvis and
he jammed.
They talked for a yeah. while. And then Elvis sang Warren's song that he had just did on the Wink Martindale song. But he did, Warren told me, he said he did the X-rated version. So you'll have to get the book to know what the X-rated version is.
I don't want to give away any secrets here. Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Let people invest in the book.
Yeah.
And so then, you finish the book and then there's an album.
Right, right. So about halfway through the book, I don't even remember who made the comment, but they said something to the effect of, man, wouldn't it be great if we had an album? You know, we just released one of Warren's earlier albums. Mm-hmm. Which got me thinking, why would we do that when we've got Warren right here? Why not just go in the studio and make another one? You know, he's 82. How many more is he going to make? Let's just go do that now. But I wanted it to sound like the original stuff that he used to do. So we got in touch with Dockside Studios,
right.
and we got Justin Tockett, who's a phenomenal engineer, and we decided to go straight to two-track, which is, if you're not familiar, you basically perform live and they record it to tape, like a tape recorder. So there's no way to fix any mistake. You know, like now if you record digitally, mm-hmm. if somebody flubs a note or if you sing off key, you can go in, each one of those instruments and vocalizations are separated. So you can go in and you can tweak it.
Uh-huh.
When you're recording to tape, it's like an old tape recorder. It's on that tape. And if somebody messes up, then the whole take is, you throw it away and you uh-huh. do it again. Which could be really frustrating because if as a vocalist, you had the best vocals ever, but somebody flubbed a note,
yeah.
then there's no way to save that.
But they're the gold standard, right?
But,
Dockside Studios.
Oh, absolutely.
Really,
and the musicians that I had with me mm-hmm. are, you know, we really and truly probably, except for maybe one song, could have done the one take on every song. And these guys went in unrehearsed. We never had a rehearsal. We went straight in. And we just recorded.
So it was like the original days.
It was just like the original days, uh-huh. yeah. It was
Gosh.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And then in the process of thinking about what songs we were going to do, my husband said, well, you got to do Matilda, because that's like the swamp pop national anthem. Mm-hmm. And you got to get Mark Broussard to sing
oh, wow.
with Warren on that song, because, mm-hmm. you know, Warren is Mark's idol, and it doesn't get, you know, this generation, that's what Mark is most soulful as you can get. So I called Mark, and Mark said, oh, heck yeah, I would be, yeah, yes, mm. yes, you know, I want to do that. And then I remember Warren saying, well, you know, we're going to do Tennessee Blues, which is a Bobby Charles number. And Bobby's a great songwriter from Abbeville. He said, Sonny Landreth recorded with me on that original version. So I said, ooh, well, maybe I can get Sonny Landreth to play on there, you know. And so I called Sonny, and Sonny was there. Absolutely, yes, I would love to. And then our saxophone player, Derek Houston, had been telling me, look, man, there's this John Fogerty song, this, you know, we got to do, Warren would just kill it. And I'm like, I got my songs already. I didn't really want to listen to it. But he kept on nipping at my heels. And I finally asked Warren, and Warren said, oh, man, I'm a huge Fogerty fan. You know, we recorded back together in 1985. We did this video shoot. And, you know, again, there's the connections were everywhere. So we decided to do the Fogerty song, and my keyboard player, Eric Adcock, jokingly said, oh, man, well, we got Mark Broussard and we got Sonny Landers. Wouldn't it be cool if we got John Fogerty to sing on this record? And we all kind of chuckled because...
It would be cool.
How do you make that happen, though? You know, like, how do you get John Fogerty? And then, you know, one thing led to another, and by the end of that day, I had an email from John Fogerty saying I would be honored to be a part of this project.
Wow.
Yeah. Gosh. So again, you know, you go home and you know, so you get that email and you go, great, hey guys, John's in, you know, and then you go home and then you process that information and you go, wait, what?
I'm so glad you got to do all this where Warren can really enjoy everything and understand how well respected he is.
And then let me just kind of put a side note on there. I was able to get funding for the projects, for both projects, so that all of the proceeds can go to Warren and help him out. Because as a musician of 72 years, you know, it's all he's ever done, really. So he doesn't have any kind of retirement or anything that he can get. So he's still working today, first and foremost, because he loves it, but he still has to pay his bills.
Right.
So I was able to do this project, and so all the book sales and the record sales go to Warren. And t-shirt sales.
Yeah. So say the name of the book and the album again, please.
So the book and the album are both titled Taking the World by Storm. The book subtitle is A Conversation with Warren Storm, and the album subtitle is A Regional Roots Journey with the Godfather of Swamp Pop.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I have one last question before I turn over the mic to Jason Sikora.
Sure.
These musicians that you've met, you know, nationally in the U.S. and abroad, is it like a small network when it comes down to it? Like, your music is different, I know, than, let's say, an Eric Clapton
right.
or a John Fogerty or whatever. But is it really a brotherhood and a sisterhood?
It is so small. It is so small. It is so ridiculously small. You can't even understand how small and how close it is. You know, people talk about 7 degrees of separation. There's not even a seventh degree of separation, because somebody that I've played with or knows somebody that has played with Eric Clapton or John Fogerty or U2 or whoever it may be, and it's all about the music.
You're right.
And the music is so much, that music community and the camaraderie and just everything that it has to offer is so close to what we here in Lafayette and Acadiana, what our culture has to honor, which is family, you know, food, creativity, music, dancing. I mean, just all of that. You know, what I experience here in Cajun culture, I experience in music culture. It's all the same.
It's the joy of creating.
It's the joy of life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful, Yvette. Well, we're here in Raider Solutions Studio, and Jason Sikora comes from a similar background. You're both guitarists, and he's super talented, and I know you've got some questions.
I have a lot of comments and a few questions.
Oh, my God. I wasn't nervous until I found out who you really were.
Well, first of all, thank you for being here. And, Jan, thank you for bringing a musician in today. So my background, I have a music degree, and I don't know how I ended up in an IT company, but...
Oh, God, now I'm even more nervous.
That's really talented.
But no, I like your attitude, and I've kind of done the same thing of just jump in the river and see what happens.
Right, see what happens.
Yeah, and I think I've said that to some other guests before, that they just end up somewhere, and they don't know how they got there, but it's because they said yes.
Yes.
So I appreciate that attitude. Also, I like that you have a smartwatch and bead bracelets, because I'm the same way.
Oh, look!
Ta-da! Thank you for letting me play your guitar. It sounds amazing and plays really, really well. I'm kind of jealous of it.
Darren Wallace is the guy who made it for me. And like I said, he's been building guitars all his life. And I think in the near future, he's considering retiring and just wanting to do this as a hobby.
Oh, okay.
And so we kind of made a little deal, and he said, "I'll build you a guitar."
I'm always amazed at people that can do, especially an acoustic guitar.
Oh, this is
and all
incredible.
The binding inside, and that's not easy work.
It's a
work.
Shame you can't see it because it's really beautiful.
Yeah. Well, we'll have the video. I'll be playing. So yeah.
Okay.
I like what you said too about musicians, especially like big famous ones, just being normal people.
Yeah.
I remember I was doing a gig in Ireland, and The Edge was backstage with his daughters, just hanging out.
Oh, he hung out with my son for an hour talking soccer. It was crazy.
Yeah, so they're just normal people that have really cool jobs.
Oh, can I give you a really, really, really quick story about that?
Of course.
All right, so I had a friend of mine who was working for the band U2, and he had moved down here, and he used to catch flack all the time. He said, "You know, I catch flack every day from these guys, and they're like, why would you move to, you know, Podunk, Louisiana somewhere? Why would you do that?" And he said, "I finally decided I'm going to show them rather than try and explain it." So when they came down to Houston to do their concert a few years back, he rented out the Continental Club, and he hired a band from Louisiana, you know, like our friends, to play. He hired a couple of us to teach these guys how to Cajun dance, and he hired somebody to cook a gumbo, you know? So we're out, we're hanging out with you two and the crew from the concert and all that stuff, and, you know, we're teaching, I taught Edge how to two-step. Another friend of mine was teaching Bono, which, sorry, Bono, but you can't really dance. But Edge did pretty good. But anyway, you know, by the time it was like 3 a.m, and we're just kind of having this big old Cajun jam on the back, and my friend Lindsay was serving gumbo, right? So he's fixing a bowl of gumbo, and he'd say, "Hey, you know, you want some gumbo?" And yes or no. So he gets to Bono, who's listening to this Cajun jam, and it's, like I said, 3 a.m, he's got his two bodyguards, he's got his sunglasses, but he's just hanging out. And so Lindsay goes, "Say, hey, Bono," he said, "you want some gumbo?" And Bono goes, "Lad, I tell ya, I'm so filled with the love and the music and the culture." And, you know, he's going on this, you know, 3-minute existential, you know, just thing. Yep. And everybody's listening. And Lindsay's holding the thing of gumbo. And Bono finishes. And Lindsay goes, "Dude, you want some gumbo or not?" And Bono goes, "No." He goes, "All right, dude, you want some gumbo?" he keeps going. And it was so great, because it's like you said, you know, when you're in that little jam session,
yep,
you're just like everybody else, you know.
Yeah.
You're just like everybody else. And I think he realized it in that moment, you know. Really, we didn't want to know anything other than, do you want a cup of gumbo?
Yeah, exactly.
And he missed out by not trying it. Maybe another time.
Yeah.
I also like what you said about how small the industry is, because it really is. And I've been out of it for 7 years now.
Yeah.
But yet, I got a call from the stage manager of Metallica the other day, just because he wanted to talk.
Right.
And I did sound for Mark Broussard at a private party.
Yeah.
And 2 months earlier, I was bowling with Switchfoot in Houston. Like, it really is that small. And once you're in it, you're kind of in it.
You're in it. And that's one thing that I forgot to say, but I can mention that right now. And my husband didn't really understand at first, or my mom, or until they saw it. When you meet another musician and you play music with them, or you share something musically, there is a bond that is formed, and you are friends forever. Like, it's just a lifelong... It's a brotherhood, I guess you could almost call it. And it's nothing you have to work at. It just happens, you know. And you might meet somebody one time, but you're his friend or her friend forever. And, you know, you can call on him 7 years down the road if you need something or just want to talk. And it's like you've been knowing them forever.
Yeah. Well, and it's the whole industry, the musicians, the roadies, the sound guys.
Yeah.
Like,
the
once you... do something
have
with somebody.
Have an interaction.
Exactly.
Of some sort.
Well,
yeah.
And from my perspective, I lived on a bus with, you know, 10 dudes.
Yeah.
So you do that for a year, you're creating some bonds there. But it's the same way with musicians. The moment you play with somebody and create something, you're together.
And it doesn't matter what genre.
No.
You know, it's cross genres for sure. It's just music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And that's why I surround myself with amplifiers and guitars in this office, because literally I'll walk by and somebody will be playing bass and I'll grab a guitar
and we just
have to step away from the desk for 5 minutes.
For a few minutes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So going back to the beginning, what did you teach at ESA?
I taught middle school science. I taught middle school for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my wife's a middle school math teacher.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I loved it. I loved the middle school. People always say, oh, my God, God bless you. I can't believe such a weird age. And I'm like, well, I'm such a weird girl. So we just kind of fit in.
Yeah. Well, and that campus is amazing.
Yeah.
What spurred you or why did you get into education?
Well, I come from a family of educators as well.
Oh, okay.
My dad was a school teacher at an early age. He became the youngest principal ever in St. Martin Parish, and he went on to work at the central office as assistant superintendent. My aunt was an educator. My great aunt was an educator. I had several great aunts who were educators. So I come from that background.
Got you.
And I kind of always knew that's what I wanted to do, but my dad had tried to talk me out of being an educator and a coach, and I think he just realized the amount of hours that it would take and kind of tried to point me in a different direction, but I mean, I knew that that's what I was supposed to be doing.
Excellent. All right, so can you talk a bit about how you choose songs to sing or your writing process?
The writing process is pretty easy to talk about because I don't do it, I guess, in this. And what I mean by that is that I will never sit down and say, or I have never really sat down and said, I'm going to write a song today. Let's see. What am I going to write about? How am I going to do this? They're a gift. They come to me. It sounds weird. I had to try and explain it to my mom. But I'll be driving down the road and you know, it'll come to me. But I will tell you this. I will back up and tell you this. I met a songwriter in 2009. Who had gone to Nashville, and he had come back home, and had asked him the question. I said, all right, you got to tell me, how do you write a song? Because it makes no sense to me. Like, I can imagine how you could maybe come up with lyrics. Mm-hmm. I can imagine how you could maybe come up with a melody, but I can't imagine how you could put the two together. It's just not making sense in my head. And he told me, he said, you know, it's pretty easy to write a song. He was real laid back. And I said, well, what's, you know, how do you do it? And he said, it's easy, man. All you got to do is pay attention. And I remember thinking to myself, jerk. You know, if you don't want to tell me how to write a song, just don't tell me. But
he was serious.
He was very serious, you know. And that weekend, there was a bunch of us that were camping up in the woods in St. Francisville. And I remember sitting around the campfire. And I started talking about school and teaching these middle school kids and how it's so different from when I used to grow up, you know. And I said, you know, we used to go to my grandmother's house every Sunday and we'd go climb trees and walk through the woods. And, you know, kids today, now they're all hanging out at bars and stuff. And, you know, we'd go every Sunday and sit at the table and everybody would share stories. And now, you know, they're not doing that now. Everybody's on their phones. And we used to play outside and nobody's doing that. And, you know, everybody's going through drive-thrus. And I'm just kind of going off on a rant. And he's just smiling at me. And when I finished, I looked at him. I'm there. Do you find that amusing? And he just looks at me and he went, there's your song.
Where memories are gold.
Yeah, where memories are gold. Mm-hmm. And once I wrote that first song, and I went home actually and I said, well, I can't write a song, but I'm going to try and remember and write down what I was talking about. And then maybe eventually I could make this into a song. So I'm writing down what I was talking about. And in that moment, like I said, I knew only three chords on the guitar. I just picked up the guitar and I started noodling around on it. And 20 minutes later, I called him and I said, do you think you can come to my house? I think I have a song. And then from that, I started paying attention. And I would pay attention about a sign on the road or something I would see. I wrote a song. I can't even remember what it was called right now, but I was eating a bag of chips and you know, I looked down and I was like, oh my God, my six pack's turned into a 12 pack. And I went, there's a song. And it came to me. A lot of times it'll come driving in the car. And sometimes they come from what I'm observing in the moment, or sometimes it'll come to me what I'm observing about past. And sometimes there'll be songs that come to me that's not even me. I have a song called Memories of Clelia, and it's written from a guy's perspective. And I was browning some meat on the stove for my son. I was cooking him supper, and I just said, I have to go get my guitar. And I went into my room And what kind of got me back into it was the fire alarm was going off.
Right, right.
Had flames on the stove, you know, the smoke, the house was filled with smoke. But I had written a song in that moment about a little girl who had passed away. And the mom had passed away too. And the little girl was telling the dad, you know, don't worry, it's going to be okay because mom's waiting for me. And he's, you know, sitting on the bed with a pistol, you know, contemplating all this stuff. And I remember thinking, well, where did that come from?
Right.
Because I sure didn't observe that anywhere, you know, and I don't know. So, the songs are a gift, mm-hmm. And they usually come together, the words and the lyrics right. and the melody. There's not too often where I have to put something down and then come back and look at it later. It's just there.
It's interesting being a songwriter. I don't write songs, but I write. I'm good at riffs and guitar parts.
Mm-hmm.
But I do write with some people here in the office, and it's interesting because you can be a musician, but you're also a storyteller.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Okay, so that's the other key. In my songs, if you listen to them, and I didn't put any thought into this is how I'm going to do it, but this is just how it happened. I think I've always been a storyteller.
Mm.
I think being a school teacher, you kind of have to be.
Yep.
An entertainer, storyteller to keep the kids engaged. But I think I had a knack for that. And whenever I write the songs, I do see the movie in my head.
Mm.
Like I do see the story in my head. And so mm-hmm. maybe it's easy that way. Maybe I see the story before I write it down. I'm not even sure. But there is definitely, you can see the video, you can see the movie, you can see the story.
Yeah.
In the lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's a very interesting process, and everybody's a little bit different.
Everybody's
but,
different.
But it's always kind of that.
Yeah.
Telling the story
mm-hmm.
and then just finding the way to put the words
in the right order and how
and,
to make
and,
it.
And even just the chords on the guitar and how
yeah.
it's going to happen. All right. Finally, how can people get more information about you? Website, Facebook page, online streaming, buy your album?
Yeah. All of the above.
Okay.
I do have a website. It's YvetteLandry.com, and Yvette is spelled Y-V-E-T-T-E, Landry.com.
Okay.
And you can follow me on Facebook. I have a Yvette Landry Band account, Yvette Landry and the Jukes, and just Yvette Landry.
Okay.
And Instagram as well, and then streaming.
Probably on all the platforms.
All of the platforms. Yeah, pretty okay. much all the platforms. Yeah, Apple Music and Spotify and Pandora.
Yep.
I just recently learned I have my own channel on Pandora.
Really?
Congratulations.
Yes, that's another one of those things like, what?
I realized I have my own channel on YouTube. Like, I can find all my music on YouTube.
Wow.
Like, how did that happen?
How did it happen? I know, it's crazy. But yeah, you know, and I have a regular gig. I play every Thursday with a steel guitar ace, Richard Como. He's probably, aside from Paul Franklin, who plays with the Time Jumpers and Vince Gill up there in Nashville, he's probably one right up there with him. So if you want to hear some good pedal steel guitar, every Thursday night at Buck and Johnny's from 7
right.
to 9.
In Brobridge.
Right there in Brobridge. And mm-hmm. it doesn't cost you anything. And you even get two glasses of free wine. So come
what?
On.
How can you say no to that?
Right? That's awesome. Well, thank you for being here today. This has been awesome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jason, thank you
thank
so
you,
much.
Jen.
I know how excited you are
yeah.
because he finally has someone who knows what he's talking about, unlike me.
I get it.
Yeah. Thanks to Raider Solutions and you, Jason, for making this show possible. And our sponsors, we have Iberia Bank that supports us and Lafayette General.
Yeah.
And Camellia Beans has been a nice supporter of us. And,
I want you
them.
To know that thank you for putting it out there. It works because, like you said in the beginning, we did not know each other.
No.
But I think I got an email that talked about this, and I checked it out, and I was hooked.
Yeah,
so,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I am sitting here. Our family uses the term cry happy.
Yes.
And it means... You know, I have been near tears a few times during this interview because
uh-huh.
I feel this is why I'm doing the podcast, Discover Lafayette, to discover our region, discover
mm-hmm.
the beauty of South Louisiana. But you bring everything that I wanted to share with people.
Aww,
so I'm about
well,
to cry
thank
again.
You.
But thank you, Yvette.
Well, you have a huge pool to pull from in this area. We have a lot of talented and gifted people. So.
Well, you are right at the top of that
chain. Oh,
thank
you. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you for making time today. And thanks to our listeners. I'm so grateful for people that follow the podcast. You can go to discoverlafayette.net to hear this podcast and others, or you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcast, including Alexa.
Including Alexa.
And, you know, I can't think of a better way to close our show than to let everyone hear your first song that you wrote, Where Memories Are Gold. So we're going to close out on that beautiful note. Thank you, Yvette Landry.
Thank you.
TV took the place of campfires and walking underneath the bright white stars. And walking in the woods turned into smoke-filled bars. Nobody takes the time to write love letters anymore. Guess the way things used to be means more now than it did before. So close your eyes and take me to the place where the black water flows. Back to a place and time where my memories are gold. Well, nobody knows their neighbors or visits with the folks on Sunday night. And sitting at the table turned into drive-through signs. And sitting with the family telling tales just don't happen anymore. Guess the way things used to be means more now than it did before. So close your eyes and take me to the place where the black water flows. Back to a place and time where my memory. Back to a place and time where my memories are gold.
Yvette Landry, thank you.
You're welcome.